Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Greetings, music nerds, and welcome to Season 6 of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. I am your host, Steve Dawson, coming to you from the Hen House Studio here in Nashville, Tennessee. I'm really excited to be bringing you this new season of shows coming to you on the first and third Wednesdays of every month. I have a great lineup of fascinating conversations with incredible musicians, songwriters, guitarists, steel guitarists, drummers, composers, who knows what else. I've been having an incredible time diving deep with these folks, and I know you're going to enjoy listening. Just a reminder that this year I've taken out the short song samples through the show, as things have gotten way more complicated as far as legal use of music goes, so I'll be making an accompanying Spotify playlist to each episode, which you'll find in the episode's show notes and at the website at makersandshakerspodcast.com. So anytime you hear this cute little slide guitar sound, you'll know there's a track to go along with it on the playlist. We have some new sponsors this year, but continue to be largely listener-supported. Your help in keeping the show going is always appreciated, and you can do it with a one-time donation or a Patreon subscription. Patreon is a monthly payment of your choice, and when you sign up for that, you get a bit of added content as well as an ad-free version of the show to listen to. If you don't feel like kicking in any dough, that's cool too, but you can help by subscribing for free on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or just spread the word by sharing the show, following us on Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, and telling all your pals about it. You can get links to all this stuff, of course, at makersandshakerspodcast.com. Meanwhile, many thanks to our sponsors this season. Please check them out and let them know that I sent you. They are Isotope, Ear Trumpet Labs, Union Tube and Transistor, Black Mountain Picks, and Spectra 1964.
Hello, folks, and welcome back to Season 6 of the show. This is episode number 126. Welcome to it. My guest today is an incredible drummer who lives and works here in Nashville, Fred Eltringham. And I hope everyone's doing well out there and getting back to work in some sort of normal capacity. If you're a musician, I am heading out to play the Edmonton Folk Festival with my band this week. So if you're in that part of the world, come and say hello. It's one of the great festivals in North America. And I'm really happy to be heading out back there this year. Hopefully we'll make it with all these crazy delays going on. Man, it's a nightmare out there. Aside from that, it's just been a lot of studio work here, sessions and mixing and stuff like that, and the studio is pretty dialed in. So if you want to come and make a record here at the Hen House, drop me a line. All right, so Fred Eltringham is here this week, and he's one of my favorite drummers around town, and he's held down the drum chair in Sheryl Crow's band for the last 10 years or so. I should add that that band is so great, and if you get a chance to see them, I mean, Cheryl's awesome, but the band is really insane, too. It's Fred and Audley Freed on guitar and Jen Gunderman on keys. The only one I don't know is the bass player, but in any case, they're one of those bands that works for a top-level artist, but they really come across as a band as opposed to a solo artist with a bunch of hired guns. I've had a chance to see them in action a few times, and they're really great, so check them out if you can. And Fred keeps pretty busy here in Nashville when he's not out with Sheryl Crow. He's played on tons of records and on stage with folks like Billy Gibbons, Emmylou Harris, Lucinda Williams. Have you heard that cool series that she did recently? I think it's 6 or 7 volumes now. They're pretty much live in the studio with a wicked band. One is like old school country classics. One is Tom Petty tunes. One is Rolling Stones tunes. I think there's a Dylan one. There's a whole bunch. I think they might only be out on vinyl. And anyway, Fred is on some or if not all of those. Who else? Willie Nelson, Darius Rucker, Kenny Chesney, Rodney Crowell, Casey Musgraves. The dude has stacked up some serious credits. Anyway, I love to talk to folks like this on the show, maybe slightly under the radar players who are super talented and you know, just get to know a little bit about their past to get them where they are now. And Fred's pretty invisible on social media, but he has a website where he posts a few things and some photos and videos that you should check out. And his dates with Sheryl Crow are up there. If you're ever able to go see them, you can find the dates there. And that is fredeltringhamdrummer.com. So before we get going here, I'd just like to shout out to a couple folks who made donations or signed up to the Patreon over the last couple weeks. They are Steve Kunzman, hopefully got that right, and Margot Greenham. Thanks, you guys. I could not do it without you. And I should also add that for Patreon subscribers, at the end of this season, I'm going to be giving away a Union Tube and Transistor reverb pedal, and it's very cool. It's this crazy, it's their first digital pedal, and I've been using it a bunch, and it's really trippy and cool. Anyway, I've got a brand new one of these sitting here, and I'm going to give it away to a random Patreon subscriber at the end of the season. So if you sign up, you will be enrolled automatically in that groovy contest. All right, so that's about it. Let's get down to it. This is my conversation with Fred Eltringham. Enjoy. Have you had a lot of COVID hit your Sheryl Crow camp?
No, not at all. No one in the band got it. And we had a couple crew members get it.
Enough to cancel shows and stuff?
No. Okay. No. I mean, we didn't tour during the major part of it or whatever. Yeah. We kind of waited a long time. But then as soon as, I guess it was the fall, we started back up.
Yeah.
And it's been fine. It was scary, but we got tests every day and, you know, all that stuff. Yeah. But everybody is vaxxed and we all kind of were required to get vaxxed. We lost a couple of crew members because of that.
Yeah, I heard the drum tech guy. I've rented drums off him before, and I heard he split.
Oh, yeah, Clay.
Clay, that sucks. That guy was awesome, man.
Well, he is awesome. Yeah, I know. It was so sad. But you know what? Clay was kind of ready to be home, I think, anyway.
Okay.
Just because he has a son with Down syndrome. And, yeah. You know, his wife works. You know, so he's been working at Forks. And he's just, I think the road was not like working for him so much anymore anyway.
Right.
And we didn't really tour that much. I mean, we tour every year. I've been with Sheryl now for 10 years, but we tour every year, mostly in the summertime. And, right. Cause during the school year, she's a single mom. So she's being mommy while she's, you know,
yeah, I guess.
And I got kids, and that makes my life a lot easier too.
Totally.
It's a good thing. And I can be home to do sessions and all that stuff. Like, and most of the people out or in the country world or whatever, are out touring during the summer anyway.
Yeah.
So like session stuff slows down a little bit during the summer anyway. So except for last year, actually during the lockdown, it was insane.
Was it? So what was your 2020 all about?
It was tons of recording. Everybody was recording.
Yeah.
Like we started up, I guess it was in June of last year, and just everybody just was making records. It was nonstop.
So were you doing, like, did you have a setup at home or anything, or were you just at that point back in the studios in Nashville?
I did a lot of stuff from home up to June.
Yeah.
And I do have a studio at home. And then it was kind of like a mishmash of both, but then it just turned into full on just regular, you know, in-person sessions and full band tracking everybody in their masks and getting tested at sessions or prior to and all that stuff. I've had so many PCR tests now.
I've had quite a few too. Yeah.
Oh yeah. My God.
Yeah. I did a bit of traveling through the summer as well. And then things kind of like petered out for me after I did a bunch of stuff in like June, July, August, and then I had a bunch more stuff sort of cancel after that. So it's been a little crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thanks for doing this, by the way. I really appreciate it.
Of course.
In reading some of the stuff that I've found about you, I think we were at Berkeley at the same time.
Really?
I think so. It seems like that. Like I heard you mention that you were there when Abe Laborial was there, which is like early 90s.
Yeah.
And that's when I was there. So
I got there, like, I went to community college first after high school. I graduated 89, went to community college for a year, and then I went to the five-week program the summer after that. So it was like 91 or something like that, I guess. 90, 91. And then I stayed for a semester. Then I went home for another, like, two semesters and went to the university in my hometown, Westchester, Pennsylvania. Then went back to Boston and did another, like, year and a half at Berkeley.
Okay.
And then I just stayed in Boston until 99.
So you were there through like 91, 2, 3 ish, in and out.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's when I was there at the same time.
Weird.
Yeah. I lived at the Commonwealth Avenue dorm, and I mean, I was playing a lot of like acoustic music, and I don't know. I mean, Gillian Welch and Dave Rawlings were there at the same time. I was in classes with those guys a bit.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah. We may have crossed paths at some point.
Yeah. I was in the rock scene. So like,
yeah,
I just started playing in like Boston rock bands, like power pop rock bands.
Yep.
Kind of right away. And that's why I went back. Actually, the band I was playing with, they were called Atlas Shrugged. The bass player, Corin, he went to Berkeley as well. We met at Berkeley. And the keyboard player, Jude Crossan. I don't know if you remember those guys at all, but
no.
Corin was in the songwriting program at Berkeley.
Okay.
That expanded out into the rock scene, like the 90s Boston rock scene.
Which was pretty healthy, right? Like there was a lot of shit going on out there with all the clubs. There was a ton of clubs and stuff.
It was so great. It was such a cool little community of people and great bands, and everybody was making records and touring. We all had our bands and going up and down the East Coast and whatever. And some people, you know, got like giant record deals, like Letters to Cleo and people like that.
Yep.
I ended up playing with this band, the Gigolo Ants, who were signed to RCA, and they had some success in like England and stuff with a couple songs getting on some TV shows and in movies and stuff. And I just started touring around with them. And we ended up touring really hard. I did that for like 6 years. And we just went everywhere and opened for everyone. It was awesome.
Yeah.
It was such a...
Did you get much studio experience in those days, or were you just like touring nonstop and that was your thing?
I did kind of, because, well, actually early on with that band Atlas Shrugged, our sound guy, this dude Ted Paddock, he ran like the... student work program or whatever in the studios there at Berkeley. And so we would go in at like midnight and record from midnight to 6 a.m.
Yeah.
making our little demos and stuff and tapes or whatever to hand out at shows.
I did a lot of that too there. It was handy.
It was awesome. It was incredible. So I did get a lot of experience there where we were doing that. And then you know, we kind of started going out to some other, like, there's Fort Apache was a studio in Cambridge where like the Pixies and all those alternative rock bands, like Julianne Hatfield and a bunch of cool bands had recorded up there. And we did a couple things with Paul Coldery there. And the Gigolo Ants were in the Q Division scene, which is another big studio in Boston. Producer Mike Dineen produced their stuff, and he had done like Amy Mann and all these other really cool bands. And he passed away a few years ago, sadly. He was an incredible producer. He taught me so much. But so I did get to do a fair amount. We did a lot of recording, as much as we could. It wasn't like session, you know, it wasn't like session work.
You were in a band and the band went into the studio. Do you remember those days as being like some of the things that would have been things that have stuck with you, like as far as how to play the drums effectively, like for tone and for feel in the studio? Like it's such a different trip than being a live drummer. Do you recall that period of time as being like a time when you really kind of started to focus in on that, or were you just not really worrying too much about the studio side of things at that time?
It's that sort of hit me in the past few years, actually, looking back on that.
Oh yeah.
In working with Mike, especially, he really knew what he was doing. You know, he's just a great producer. So yeah, getting the right, you know, snare sound, or, you know, tuning the toms the right way and the kick drum and muffling stuff the proper way to get the right sound for each song and all that. Yeah, that was the beginning of it for me.
Was it him that taught you a lot of that stuff, or were you kind of versed in that through Berkeley and through?
Berkeley, there was not much of that going on. Actually, I started taking a studio drumming lab there at Berkeley.
Yeah.
And I remember the first couple classes, there was a bunch of, like, you know, like fusion drummers there, because that's they love that stuff there, which sure. I was into at the time too, I gotta admit. And but I also, you know, I came out of, you know, rock and roll was my thing, you know, growing up, like, that's what I loved, like classic rock.
Yeah.
I remember the teacher smartly put on a Beatles record, and as an example of great drum sounds, you know.
Yeah.
And all the other guys in the class were like
laughing,
kind of bagging
it.
They were bagging on Ringo, and I was like,
fusion drummers love to bag on Ringo.
I know. It made me so upset. I actually quit the lab.
Really?
It was so sad. I was like, these are not my people. I cannot be in this lab. No, I didn't learn a ton at, you know, from the Berkeley curriculum or whatever, as far as studio drumming went. So, and I never really, like, aimed to be a studio drummer, you know, like session drummer or whatever.
Yeah.
It was not on my list of, you know, things. I was just thought I was going to be in a rock band, a huge rock band. You know what I
mean? Yeah. So that was the goal from day one, kind of.
Yeah, just to be in a massive power pop rock band, you know. Right, that was right. So the session stuff really did not kick into gear until I moved here in like 2007. I'd done a bunch of records and stuff up to then. Actually, the first like big record I ever played on was in Boston. It was like that girl Tracy Bonham.
Oh yeah.
That was with Paul Coldery and Sean Slade, the guys who did, like, they had mixed some Radiohead record. They did the Bends, and they did, I think they had mixed the very first Pablo Honey, that first Radiohead record, and they had done Hole and all this, you know,
heavy hitters.
Huge, yeah, some big alternative rock things. They were producing that, and Josh Fries played on most of the record, who I think he's actually a little younger than me, but he was already like a LA session drummer at that time. And he came in to play on that. And then they had a couple more songs to do. And I had auditioned for Tracy to play with her live, but didn't get the gig. Then they called me in. The bass player, Drew Parsons, was one of my best friends, and we had lived together, and that's, you know, that whole world kind of came together for him through us all being around each other. And so they called me in to come to play on the last couple tracks. And
how did that go?
That was awesome. It was incredible. And that record ended up being like a gold record and everything else. That was my very first, like, on the card session.
Yep. Yeah.
And I was like, wow, that's pretty amazing, you know. But then I never thought, like, well, I'm just going to be a session guy now. But
so that particular experience didn't necessarily lead directly to, like, a bunch of studio work in LA where.
No, where, no. Okay. I wasn't living in LA. I was still living in Boston.
Oh, you were. Okay. Your path, though, was you lived in Boston for a while, played in those bands, but you did spend time in LA and New York, right? Before you came here. Is that right?
Did. Yeah. So, like, after I left the Gigolo Ants, I started playing with Juliana Hatfield.
So how did that happen? Did you quit that band, or that band broke up? And then were you looking for work for a while, or how did the Juliana Hatfield gig come around?
Yeah, I left the band. I kind of got burnt out on it. We had sort of exhausted a lot of our...
I know the feeling. You know,
you know, we made a couple records and we just opened for everybody and touring around really hard, touring in bands and sharing.
You were like the perpetual opening band.
Yeah, we were. And we were awesome. We were a killer band. When I listen to those records, I go like, man, we were so good. But it was a different time, and you know, and that doesn't happen for everybody, you know.
Yeah.
And so I just was like, I need a break from that, and, you know, I just need to get out. And someone, I forget how I had got recommended to Juliana. Somebody in the Boston rock scene, you know, had given her my name or something.
Did she go to Berkeley as well?
She did go to Berkeley, yeah.
Okay.
But I think she was a few years ahead.
You didn't know her there.
I didn't know her there.
Okay.
And she actually graduated from Berkeley, I think.
Okay. But, wow, one of the few.
I know. It is what it's rare. Yeah. And she initially had called me to do a tour, and I said no. Cause I was like, really? I was ready to go back to school. I had been accepted to UMass for their nursing program. I was wow. I'm gonna go into nursing. I'm just gonna go after the normal.
I'm done.
Yeah. I'm just gonna have a normal life. I was working at this kind of fancy restaurant on Beacon Hill as like a food runner, and I was making really good money and all this stuff. And I was already with my wife, my now wife, or then wife too. We got married in '96. We've been together a long time. But so after she called me, I said no. And then like a couple, maybe a week later, my wife was like, what are you doing? you should absolutely just take that tour, you know?
Was she established at that time or was she like an unknown artist?
No, Juliana had already done the Juliana Hatfield 3 okay. or whatever.
Yep.
And she had played with the Lemonheads, playing bass. She had already, Blake Babies, all that happened. Stuff.
Okay.
This was 1999. So mm-hmm. she had already done a ton of stuff. But she had a new record out. And her drummer, Todd Phillips, who was in the Juliana Hatfield band, wasn't able to do it or something. So I called her back and I said, you know, if the position's still there, I'll do it with yeah. my tail between my legs. And she was like, okay, sure, yeah.
That was kind of a fluke that she hadn't filled the spot or whatever.
Oh, yeah, I lucked out. And so that was awesome, actually. The bass player for that was this guy, Josh Latanzi. And the guitar player was John Skibick, who had been in the Gigolo Ass with me. So maybe that's why. Maybe that's how I got. Maybe John recommended me.
Yep.
And so we toured around for a bunch of months during that year. And Ben Queller was opening for us.
Okay.
And Josh, the bass player, had played with Ben in his solo, and actually in Radish, Ben's old band, and in Ben's solo thing. And so we toured around for months. I went home, and then I decided to move to LA, actually. And
because, like, what was drawing you there?
I think I was just kind of like, well, I'm going to go try and make it, you know. Yeah. I'm just going to go get out of Boston.
Yeah,
the 90s rock scene was sort of dying down a little bit. A lot of the bands had either broken up or moved on. A lot of people actually had moved to LA. And so I was like, all right, well, let's just make a move and see what happens. And my wife is originally from Thousand Oaks, California.
Okay.
Right outside of LA. So we had family there and stuff. And so we went there and really struggled. It was a really difficult time. I was like, did a couple little gigs with some people, did some recording. I actually made a connection with this old friend of mine who recorded some Gigolo and stuff. His name is Charlton Pettis. He's a producer. He by chance lived a few blocks away from where we were living, and he was working with Kurt Smith from Tears for Fears. And so he called me one day and was like, hey, can you come over and play some drums for Kurt? And I was like, yes, absolutely. So I went over there and we started working on Kurt's solo record. in Charlton's garage.
Wow.
That actually, that eventually turned into making a whole Tears for Fears record because they reunited during that time.
And you just stayed on board.
They had me come in and and play drums on all the stuff that we had kind of demoed up. And cool. They were like writing and I kept going back in and doing stuff with that. So I never got into like the LA session world at all. But
why is that, do you think? I mean, obviously, like, it's sort of a closed club in a way, but you haven't run into those problems here. What was it about LA that was just like a closed door for you, do you think?
That early on, like, I didn't really know a lot of people there at all. So it was just kind of like, I didn't know what I was doing. You know, I was just kind of floundering around. And so that happened. And then I got called by Ben Queller, actually called me while we were living in LA. He was in New York and said, "Hey, I just finished my first solo album. Do you want to come be in my band?" Because my drummer bailed on it. And Josh Latanzi, who had been in Juliana's band, was going to do that, playing bass. So we were like, thank God, yes. We were like, let's get out of here and go. We would always wanted to live in New York.
So how long was your stint in LA? Just like a year or something? Or were you there long?
That was 2 years during that time. Then we moved to New York and did 2 years there. So I toured with Ben. We went all over the world. It was awesome.
He was really big at that time, right?
Yeah, his record Shasha did really well. And he was, we toured with all the little emo bands that were coming out, Dashboard Confessional and all these cool little indie rock bands and stuff. And actually, I mean, like Kings of Leon did their first tour opening for us.
Oh, cool.
My Morning Jacket was opening for us.
Did you play on his records too, or were you just doing the tour?
I ended up playing. I played on his second solo record. It's called On My Way.
Oh, okay, cool.
But during that time, while we were making that record with Ethan Johns, who's an awesome producer, the Wallflowers, who I had become friends with on the Gigolo Ants, one of those Gigolo Ants tours where we opened for everyone in the world. The bass player and I have become really good friends, Greg Richley. He called me up and said, "Hey, Mario, our drummer, just quit. And we were wondering if you want to come play with us." And I was like, "Yes, absolutely." You know,
did you have to quit the Ben Queller gig to do that?
I did. I had to quit Ben. So that was sad. It was kind of a drag and it was really difficult. But so I said yes to the Wallflowers gig.
At the time, were they like, where were they at in their trajectory? Like, was that when they were massive, or was that just before? Like, where was
no? This was 2003, the end of 2003.
Okay,
going into 2004. So I think I played my first shows with them the end of 2003, and they had made, I think, two other records after Bring It Down the Horse, which was their massive record.
Right. Yeah.
They were just touring, you know, and doing random stuff and getting ready to, we're trying to get ready to make another record.
So when you jump into a new situation like that, say the Wallflowers, where it's a band, it's a bunch of guys that have more or less had probably been playing together for a long time. There's probably strong personalities. There's, you know, all kinds of stuff to navigate where you're not just like necessarily hired to do a gig or a tour, but you want to like actually kind of fit into the band, I'm guessing, so that you continue to, like, it sounds like at this time you were thankful for the work, you needed the work and you wanted to keep the work. What sort of skills do you think you either had or you had to develop at that point to like manage to fit in and like play the appropriate stuff? Was there ever any direction in that regard, or did you just show up, start playing, and it fit perfectly?
It was kind of it was a really good fit, actually. We had sort of all become buddies on the road. Greg and I, the bass player, had done some other little recording projects and stuff, and I had been able to hang out with Jacob and Rami on some other little things. And so it was kind of like, I already sort of knew him. I didn't really know him, but I, you know, we knew that we all got along pretty well already. And I'm super easygoing. And so, like, you know, I did my homework and I'm, you know, I was a Matt Chamberlain fan already. Yeah. And so, like, learning those parts was really fun for me and getting to play that music. Like, when I first saw them play, I was like, man, I would love to be in a band like that. You know, that's the kind of band I want to be in. So it was like, it was a really good fit, you know. It kind of, it just fell together naturally. There wasn't like much like, play it this way, or, you know, it was kind of just like, it was like, I sort of eased into the band really, really seamlessly.
Tell me about your level of preparedness. Like when you actually showed up, how much work had you done to learn all the material and like, you know, where were you at with their repertoire?
Well, they probably had just given me like a list of songs to learn for the gig coming up or whatever we had coming up. You know, I think it was there was a bunch of shows we were going to play opening for the Counting Crows or something. Yeah. And so they probably just gave me a set list of things to learn. And I just woodshed and did it, you know?
Yeah.
And went in and played, you know, it's real. Jake hates rehearsing. So like, perfect. We just went into his little studio in his backyard and I probably was overprepared, you know, it was like, you know, I was like, we probably played through each song once and was like, okay, great. We're ready. You know, I was like, really? Okay, cool. And it wasn't a big to do, you know, it was just kind of like, here we are. We're just a rock band, you know?
Yeah. And it was a natural fit for you musically, obviously, like you fit right in there and that seems right up your alley as far as what you're used to doing. It wasn't a stretch for you probably, but it was a great gig at the time.
Yeah. Right? I mean, I was probably nervous and I felt the pressure, you know what I mean, of living up to the gig and the music and everything. And I wanted it to be great. So I did my homework.
So you mentioned Matt Chamberlain, who did play on a lot of that earlier Wallflower stuff. How much of an influence were some of the guys that are like that, like a little older than you maybe, but that were, you know, playing in the contemporary bands and stuff like that? Like, I'm guessing a lot of your influences were more like in the early rock era.
Rico, oh yeah.
Bonham, people like that. But who, but were there contemporaries that you really looked up to, like Matt maybe? Yeah.
For that world, definitely. I mean, like, Matt and Josh Freese, the stuff he was doing. And Abe was, you know, out there doing tons of cool stuff. And
were you friends with him from Berkeley?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. When I went to the 5-week program, he was like the first guy drummer there that I saw that I was like, okay, I'm doing the right thing. This guy is amazing. I need to know who he is. You know, he was Noel Redding was doing a clinic which was pretty funny. And Abe, it was a bunch of teachers and then Abe playing drums with guys. And, so right after that, I walked up to the stage after the show and introduced myself to him just to tell him how much I instantly loved his drumming and we got to be buddies. It was cool. And then, you know, he dabbled in the Boston rock scene too. Like he played with Letters to Cleo for a little while.
He did
some shows with them and did some recording and stuff. So we got to be pals and we still talk and he's hooked me up with tickets to go see McCartney and stuff. And he's so sweet. So sweet. And he was dating a girl in the performance department who helped me get an audition to get like scholarship to Berkeley and stuff. Oh. So And he had me sub for him on a couple things that were like way out of my league.
Really?
Like, cause he can play everything. Like he's a great jazz drummer, everything. And so he would be like, hey, can you cover for me for this rehearsal on this big show? And I was like, yeah, sure. And I showed up completely like unprepared and just like, oh my God, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. Yeah. Trying to sight read these things and going like, oh my God,
what's your relationship with jazz? Like, I'm guessing, like, it, from what I know of you, you've grown up playing in rock bands all the time. At Berklee, they kind of teach stuff from a jazz perspective, regardless of what style of music you're playing. I assume you've probably listened to jazz through your life. I don't know if you still do or much, but have you played it much? Did you study it?
I did study it, and I still love jazz, and I listen to it all the time, actually, and I'm a big fan. But, when I was little, you know, the most jazz things that I've been turned on to is like Buddy Rich and that kind of big band sort of, you know, that whole style or whatever. And, you know, and through Modern Drummer magazine, you get turned on to all these guys.
Right.
But you see Tony Williams on the cover of Modern Drummer and if you're 9 years old or whatever,
you're going to check it out.
You just go like, oh, that guy looks cool. But, I didn't know anything about like bebop or, you know, real avant-garde jazz or anything until I went to Berklee, and I had some really great private instructors who turned me on to all the great jazz stuff. And I'm glad they did.
Were there some guys in particular that influenced you in some way, whether it was directly or not?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, like Tony Williams and mm-hmm. Max Roach and like Art Blakey and, mm-hmm.
Elvin Jones, maybe?
Elvin, of course. Yeah. I mean, there's so many incredible guys. And it's still a part of my, sort of education. I've never played a jazz gig in my life. You know, no one's calling me to come play a jazz gig. But I still play along to jazz records and stuff just for fun and just for practice. To keep myself in shape and just to, you know, do something different and expand my brain a little bit and, you know.
Yeah.
I love jazz music. I do.
Yeah, that was a pretty exciting time for drums. There was a lot of ground being broken and like it sort of developed a new role for itself in that era.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, culturally, everything is just like, yeah. I remember teachers would get upset with me. I said, I would say that stuff and they'd be like, you're a drummer. You can do it. You can do it. You're good at jazz. You know, you can swing. You got it. And I'd be like, no. And I'm still kind of that way.
right.
But I think it really helps, you know, your swing. You know, it's important for me to have some swing in my playing. I think it just helps your feel. And, I think it's important to know about that stuff as a drummer.
Yeah. And so how long was your stint with the Wallflowers? Were you touring with them for, was that years and years?
It was like 9 years.
Crap. That's a lot.
Yeah. I know. It was a long time, but it was kind of like broken up. And because people either leaving the band or like different things happening where, we would just take breaks, you know what I mean?
Jacob did a solo record in there somewhere too, didn't he?
Did two solo records. We made a record while I was in the band. It was a great record. It's called Rebel Sweetheart. Brendan O'Brien in Atlanta. And it was awesome. Totally incredible. That was another great studio learning experience for me.
Can you tell me a bit about that? Like what it was like working with him? And when you say that you did learn some things studio wise, like specifically what kind of things were new to you?
Well, just like, he's, you know, his production, that was such the sound of so many of those rock bands of the 90s, that huge alt rock scene, Stone Temple Pilots and Soundgarden or whatever, you know, Pearl Jam and all those huge. So just the sound of those drums and the way he wanted like the snare drum to sound and stuff like that, just the open sort of tuning and sort of ringy but real live and exciting sounding.
Like
I learned how to get that sound, you know what I mean?
Yeah. But, so how much of that is your approach physically versus the microphone technique, say?
Well, I sort of kind of played that way anyway, just because coming up through the 90s and, you know, that was sort of the sound to go for and be a part of to have, you know, stuff get out there, you know. But Brendan was just like, he is such a great producer as far as like making decisions and knowing when something is done and, you know, knowing when you got the track and knowing what things to put on top. He's an incredible musician, incredible guitar player and keyboard player, and just a really smart, funny dude. Just great. A great leader.
Really puts you at ease in the session and stuff.
Totally. Just gets the job done and knows how to make it happen. He's just like a real producer, you know, like someone who knows how to make things happen in the studio. He just knows right. how to do it.
Yeah.
And so that was such a great experience. I mean, and he worked harder than any of us.
Like really?
He would take the tracks home and like sing on them at night and come back and have all this stuff done. And like, it was inspiring. He was so good.
What kind of time frame were you spending on a record like that at that time?
I guess it took like about a month total or something like that.
Oh, wow.
Like
okay.
We were going down there and staying in Atlanta. You know, I think we did like 2 weeks of tracking. And
is that where he's based or something? Why Atlanta?
Yeah, he was based in Atlanta at the time.
Okay.
But now I think he's based in LA. Finally moved to LA, but that's where like he did all his Black Crowes things and kind of stuff. So Rami Jaffe, our keyboard player, quit the band, and so Jacob wanted to take a hiatus. Mm-hmm. The drag, because it was only a few months into this touring, and I was like, okay. I had a little baby.
What year was it? This is around 2005 or something?
That record came out 2006, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. So our first son was like one. Or no, I guess we had two. We had both our babies. We had two babies at that time. And so I had to find another gig. I was like, I got to do something or else I'm just going to be working at, you know, Costco or whatever, trying to make ends meet. And
so you're back in LA at this point, or were you in Nashville?
Yeah, we were back in LA.
Okay.
I started snooping around to try and find some work and reached out to Michael Bland, actually, drummer who played with Prince in the New Power Generation. I met him on a Paul Westerberg tour that the Gigolo Ants did, so you know, because we opened for everybody.
yeah
and me, Michael and I had hit it off and we were buddies, and so I just emailed him and I said, have you heard of any drumming gigs out there that, you know, I might be good for? And he said actually, I just turned down a tour with the Dixie Chicks. And I was like, oh, that could be cool. I didn't really know any of their music. I knew Wide Open Spaces. I had seen that on VH1, and I was like, wow, that's a really great song. I love that song. So I was like, okay, cool. And he sent me the tour manager's email. So I emailed the tour manager, and I was like, hey, Michael Bland, give me your number or gave me your email address. I'm just checking to see if you guys have found a drummer yet. And, you know, whatever. I'm in the Wallflowers at the moment, but I'm kind of looking for something to do while we're on hiatus. And he said, yeah, we haven't found anybody yet. So here's our band leader, David Grissom. Here's his email.
Oh, like Mellencamp's David Grissom.
Yeah. Is that?
Oh, wow. Okay.
He was their band leader.
Okay.
He's like, so send him, you know, an email and just get it going. I was like, okay, cool. Email David. And that went through about a month of going kind of back and forth. David eventually, about a couple weeks in, told me that they were going in a different direction. I sent in like a package or whatever. I didn't even know what I was doing. I was sending like a little resume, like a resume. Yeah. Like, I didn't really have a resume. I was just kind of like, here's what I've done, you know.
At that point you had a pretty impressive track record, so there's that.
Kind of, I guess, but it wasn't, I mean, to me it wasn't that impressive. It was just kind of like me flailing through, you know, whatever, trying to get through life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, oh, okay, this is over. But then I thought, well, maybe I have one more avenue in the Chicks world where I could possibly still get into this, because I had checked out more of their music and I was like, man, this could be a really cool thing. It could be a good fit. I really liked a lot of their music. I was like, wow, this is pretty cool.
Who would have been drumming on their records?
Greg Morrow played on most of their.
Okay.
And then I reached out to Gary Loris from the Jayhawks, who had become a friend through the Wallflowers. And I knew that he had been writing with the Chicks.
Okay.
And so I said, hey, Gary, I don't know if there's any way. You don't have to do this if you don't want to. If you put in a good word for me with the Chicks, you know, just to see if maybe they would be willing to have me come in and audition or whatever. He's like, absolutely, no problem.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So he called Natalie and said, hey, my friend Fred once played, you know, wants to audition for you guys. So they called me up and I went to the Village recording studio in Westwood and sat there for an hour or two with Natalie and Marty, just talking. Didn't play a single note. And we just hit it off and had a blast. And 2 days later, they called me with the gig.
You never played?
I never played. They had never even seen me play or known.
Oh, shit.
They had no idea who I was, like, at all. I mean, of course. And so, like, they were like, so show us. I had shown them a couple of Wallflowers videos and stuff, or, you know, some songs. Yeah. That, while we were sitting there just kind of goofing around at the studio. And it was just like an easy hang.
That's everything. Right.
Yeah.
It's amazing to me in hearing you talk about like your path and your trajectory is in that, like, you're a poster child for the whole, like, you know, keeping in touch with people and like the hang, the hang being important. Like it just seems, well, like every gig you've ever got has been somebody referring. Like, I mean, that's how it happens. But like, really, yeah. Nothing came out of the blue for you. It's all like past friends and connections and meeting people on the road. It's pretty remarkable,
yeah.
Actually.
Yeah, that's exactly what it was. People I admired and just became pals with on the road, just guys, you know, and I was like, oh, this guy's cool. And, you know.
So the Dixie Chicks thing, did you feel like it was a process that you had to really kind of nurture, or was it like a quick thing that happened?
That was a lot of homework.
Yeah. Like, what was going on? Were they auditioning other people or something while they were not really saying what they were looking for? Or?
I don't think they had auditioned, maybe. I mean, I knew that Kenny Aronoff had been up for the gig.
Oh.
And that they had asked Michael, because Michael had recorded with them and Kenny through David. And maybe
so
there
Kenny,
was.
So Kenny Aronoff didn't get the gig?
He didn't get the gig. But, oh. You know, I mean, there could have been a number of factors leading into that, money or whatever,
you right.
know, and there, so I don't know for sure, but like I got the gig and I had to do a ton of homework. It was really hard. It was like a lot of songs to learn. I was living in a little two bedroom apartment with, you know, I had a little electronic kit set up for practicing. So I would have to go and I would rent out a room at this place in the valley. I forget what it's called now, like a rehearsal place. And I would go in there and just shed these songs.
Did they give you a pretty specific list of songs, or were you just having to learn their entire catalog?
No, they sent me, Grissom called, when he called me with the gig, he was like, all right, I'll send you the songs for the tour, you know, or whatever. Yeah. So there was a nice big list of songs to learn. And then we went in and started rehearsing. We rehearsed for a week as the band before they even came in and started singing.
Oh, okay. And on a gig like that, where it's pretty slick, you know, pop stuff, are you on clicks and stuff like that? Or are they playing to tracks and things like that too, or not really?
Yeah, only a couple songs had tracks, maybe two songs had tracks. But the rest, they liked having a click. And that was my first gig, having to play the whole show, yeah. Click, too.
How was that? Fine, or was it weird?
It was fine. It was totally fine. You know, and that was a great learning experience for me, too, actually. And working on having in-ears. Like, I'd never done a gig with in-ears.
Yeah. It's an adjustment, right? Like, it's not a... For some people, it's a huge nightmare, too. Like, it doesn't translate well. But was it easy enough for you to just jump in and do that?
Kind of was. Yeah, it was. I mean, it's saved my hearing a little bit, I'm sure. But it was definitely an adjustment. It was kind of odd. Especially, like, going and, you know, playing, like, these were my first... This is my first arena tour, you know, playing big arenas, headlining arenas.
Yeah.
And so getting up there for the first time on an arena stage and playing the show, and you can't really hear the audience or, you know, like, you know, what's the stage sound, the live, you know, guitar, all the amps were like under the stage and everything. It was like one of those things. And so that was a completely, completely different experience for me. I was used to rock bands kind of thrashing it out and having shitty monitors, and you just go, okay, how do we do, you know? But,
was it an adjustment for like how you actually physically played, like the amount, like how hard you played and how you projected and things like that? Was that something that changed when you started playing in places that size?
I think it was. It definitely, I had to adjust a little bit. They wanted it to rock. Like, this was their, they had done the Rick Rubin, it was the Rick Rubin record where they had Chad Smith played drums on the record. And like,
right.
So they were just into this, like, we are a rock band now. We are going to rock, you know?
Okay.
I was like, okay, I can rock out. And so I still was kind of, you know, I had to hit pretty hard. You know, they wanted it to be pretty rocking.
Yeah.
And
through the years, like, drum wise, has your setup evolved and changed? I guess, like, from gig to gig, it probably changes a little bit, but have you been pretty consistent as far as, like, the one thing that I notice is that your physical presence is unusual. Like, you're over the drums. It looks like you've got them set up pretty low or something. Is that right?
Yeah. I do set up a little weird as far as like that kind of goes. My drums are set up low and I sort of sit high.
Yeah.
Which I didn't even realize was weird until until people started pointing it out, like, wow, you sit really high and your drums are so low. And I was like, oh, I didn't realize it was.
Was that something that evolved or did you always play like that?
It's funny. I think it did evolve because I tried like looking back at like pictures and stuff from like when I was younger.
Yeah.
And I think my stuff was higher up. It definitely was. Mm-hmm. And I've actually in the past year or two, I've started lowering my seat back down a little bit to get to.
Yeah,
just to level it out a little more so my back isn't so like hunched over as much. And
it's funny, I did a session with you, I don't know, 3 years ago or something like that, down on Music Row, and your tech showed up, like, well, I was setting up my pedal steel to play and your tech showed up and set up your drums, and I was like, wow, that's weird. There's no way it, like, I figured he was some guy that didn't know the setup or whatever. And then you walked in and sat down and it was like perfect. But from a non-drummer's perspective, it was really weird seeing the kit set up that way. It looked like there was no fucking way that it was going to work, but it totally was your perfect setup.
I know, it's so weird. The studio stuff too, like the way snare drum sounds will change through, popularity or whatever. Like,
right.
Like the fat kind of deep snare sound you get more from like not playing rim shots or whatever, you know, like playing on the head.
Yeah.
And I think I started lowering my snare down to kind of get that sound for a lot of it.
Not getting rim shots on every snare hit. Okay. So when you show up for a session, we've talked about all these bands that you're actually sort of in a band for, but like when you show up at a session, like when I did a session with you where you have no clue what the music's going to be, or nobody does that shows up, and your tech shows up and brings in a kit for you to play, is there any consideration beforehand of what that kit's going to be? Like, I'd imagine you've got, in Cartage, you've probably got a bunch of different options or whatever. How do you make those decisions?
Well, now I have like two different kids that go to every session. I'll have like a regular kid or whatever that's like it's pretty standard sizes, you know, like 22 inch yeah. kick, 20 or 13 inch tom and a 16 inch floor tom. And then I have the smaller drums. And I have some drums with no bottom heads now and all kinds of, you know.
Do you get into those details with the producer beforehand or do you just kind of like guess? And
no, yeah. I mean, most of the time, as you know, like the producers will not, you don't talk much about what's going to happen on, you don't know a whole lot about what the session's going to be or what the music is at all until you get there.
Yeah.
You kind of just have, your Drum Paradise does my cartage and I just have them bring everything now.
What's the smaller kit you're talking about? What are the sizes of that kit?
That's like a 12 inch tom, mm-hmm. 20 inch kick drum, 14 inch floor tom.
Okay. So it is.
It's not like that much smaller, but a little smaller. It's more like jazzier kind of kit or whatever.
Are there any other unusual aspects to your studio, general studio setup?
I mean, sometimes I'll bring in like some random, I've been known to use trash can lids or like wash tubs or different kind of like big decorative metal plates or whatever that just kind of have a cool sound or
yeah
stuff that I'll buy at like Goodwill, little trinkets or things to hit on that sound kind of cool.
Yeah,
that sort of stuff goes in and out of, I don't know, it's like it's not very often that you get to use that stuff. Maybe more on like Americana type sessions, they want that kind of
albums sort of, rather than a two song session or whatever.
For mainstream, you know, like country session or something, you're not going to end up using that kind of stuff too often. But if somebody's making more of like an artsy kind of Americana type record.
With the Sheryl Crow gig, you mentioned that, so that's been like your main gig for the last 10 whatever years. I was playing up in Quebec City and I saw you guys playing, I think you were opening for Brad Paisley or it was like a double bill with Brad Paisley or something. I didn't know Audley at the time. I know Audley a little bit and Jen, I know Jen a bit now and stuff, but I didn't know anyone then, but it really struck me that you guys seemed like a band. Like it didn't seem like a bunch of hired guns up there that were disconnected or anything. It seemed like a full-on band. Is that something that she instills in you guys or was it just like a natural thing?
We were a band. I mean, we Audley and I got the Dixie Chicks gig at the same time.
Oh, he was in the band at the same time. Okay.
Yeah. That's okay. Where we met. And right from then on, like Audley and I have been touring together since then, since 2006. Right. He did this tour for Jacob's first solo album. We did that together. And then tons of stuff locally we've done together. When I moved here in 2007, we were playing together at the old family wash like all the time. We did a thing called Sons of Zevon where we would do all these cover tunes and different people would come in and sing and play. So we became a band and Jen was on all those things as well.
Yep.
And Robert, our bass player, Robert Kearns, he and Audley had a band called Cry of Love together. Robert has been part of the whole, you know, just tons of stuff around Nashville, you know, in the scene.
Yep.
And then Peter actually from Cheryl's band, Peter Stroud. He's been her band leader for like 20 plus years now. Mm-hmm. We put together a band called Big Hat, where it was Keith Gaddis, who's a Nashville singer songwriter from Texas originally, but who Audley and I and Jen played with on and off for years. Mm-hmm. And Robert played bass, and this guy, Ike Stubblefield, played keys in that band. Jen was not in Big Hat. So we had a band that we went and recorded some songs actually with Nick Didia, who was Brendan O'Brien's engineer.
Oh, okay.
Peter's an Atlanta guy. Peter's really was good pals with Brendan and all that whole crew down there. So we went down and recorded songs and tried to get this band going, sort of. We never ended up playing any gigs. And so during that time, Cheryl decided that she would prefer to have a Nashville-based touring band.
Okay.
Just to make it easier for her touring-wise, because her guys were kind of all spread out. And Peter was like, well, we have this band. If you're interested in trying these guys out, you know.
And, take them off.
Yeah. And that worked out. Jen ended up joining like a year later.
Okay.
There was a different keyboard player for a while.
Yep.
From the last incarnation of her band.
How important is it to you finding a bass player that you, I mean, obviously, like, you want a bass player that you lock in with, but are there times where that's like kind of a deal breaker, or like that you found yourself in a situation where you're like, this guy is, I can jive with this guy?
I mean, I've been really fortunate. It's like, yeah, almost every band I've been in or every situation, it's like super high level of musicianship and high level of just people, you know, really great people.
Yeah.
So I have had very, very seldom have I, and on any instrument in any situation, you know, it's pretty rare when I've been like, oh, this guy sucks or whatever, you know. I've just been really, seriously, I've been super fortunate to be in most situations where it's like, everybody's good in this band, you know, every right. Almost every.
That is really fortunate, actually. That doesn't happen to everybody, and that's cool.
Yeah, and in Nashville, I mean, it's just like, there's so many incredible musicians here.
Yeah.
That it's hard to go wrong, really. Right. I mean, there's guys that, you know, it just comes down to personality and stuff, like, guy can be the most incredible bass player, but maybe we don't get as along, as we don't gel personality wise right away or something. Or
yep.
For the most part, I have not had any issues musically with people where I go like, this guy, you know, it's usually me going like, I suck, you know, I'm going like, I can't hang with these guys. I'm not good enough to be right. This group of people. Well,
so you guys all like grouped up, got the gig with Sheryl Crow, and was she directive at all about what she wanted? And like, she's a pretty kick-ass drummer herself, right?
She's not a drummer. It's the one instrument.
I thought she played drums.
No.
Oh, okay.
It's shocking, right? Because, and she always says like, I wish I could play drums. And I know she could if she really, I've seen her recently. She's done a couple videos where she'll sit down and she was playing like kick drum and maybe snare and tambo and stuff on some of those lockdown videos or whatever. But no, she's okay. Not
somebody told not, me she was that she'd bought up a bunch of those Rolling Bomber kits that are
got,
so,
yeah, she's got a couple of bomber kits, and then she's bought a bunch of the, she just loves the art of those, she,
okay,
the, like the beautiful craftsmanship. She's really into like antiques and that kind of that style, that look. And so she bought a bunch of those old bass drums that had those painted drum heads and stuff too, the scenery on them and all that. And Clay, my old tech, he helped her acquire a bunch of those. And like, cause he's into the big antique scene and he's a drum collector. And she is an admirer of that, of the craftsmanship of that kind of stuff. Yeah. And just great old instruments. She has a huge collection of guitars and basses. Keyboard, she's got everything.
Yeah,
you know, she loves that stuff.
So has she used all you guys on all her recordings since then?
She has, yeah. I mean, we've all been on different recordings since we've been in the band. I mean, maybe not like full records, like not even I have been on, like her last record she made, Threads, it was a big sort of collaborative project with a bunch of different singers and artists who she's been pals with or has done things or admired through the years. Steve Jordan, she brought Steve in to produce that, not only because he's incredible, but because he is friends with everyone. You know, he knows everybody in the band. He's played with everybody, and he is good at, he was very good at bringing everybody together to get those situations. I played on like three or four tracks on that or whatever. So, and I had, you know, the chance to work with Steve Jordan and have him produce.
How was that?
Incredible. He's so, yeah. I mean, he's always been a hero of mine. I've seen him play with Keith Richards and the Winos. That's, you know, I just love his drumming. I love his whole thing. He's one of the smartest guys. He's like an encyclopedia of groove. American music. And
was he directive about your drumming at all, or was he just like, you're the drummer?
Yeah, a little bit. But not overbearing at all, or, you know, nothing. He, you know, I think he was super respectful and just really cool and wanted me to just play and be comfy and just like, you know, just like any good producer wants out of the people that come in and play, you know.
So yeah, he knows
what he's doing. And yeah, it was so cool. Just so, he's like amazing. A really great dude. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's so smart and awesome to be around.
Is there, for someone like you that's had such a great career so far and you're still young enough to have lots ahead, like, do you have a particular moment or two, either in the studio or live, that are like really stick out as highlights for you musically, or just like where you're looking around going, how the hell did I get here?
Man, I've had a bunch of those actually.
How was playing with Willie Weeks?
That was incredible. Willie's he's a monster.
Yeah.
And again, one of the sweetest people on earth. So kind and just so great at his instrument. There's no question about anything, you know. It's just kind of, you don't have to talk about anything, you just kind of just play, and then you just then you just talk about regular life, and, you know, it's like a nice normal hang. We actually got to do something really cool together, which was a huge highlight for me, on those the Skyville Live shows that they were doing from Nashville for a while. Where they would bring in different people to it was like a...
Is that the thing you did with Billy Gibbons?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was the highlight. I mean, and Willie was on that.
Oh,
I did two episodes with Billy. The first one, Willie was on. Second one, Steve Mackey, another great bass player, was on. But to do that with Willie, yeah, it was just incredible, man.
Were those just like thrown together, or like, did you know Billy Gibbons? Had you played with him before?
No, I had not known him. The producer of the show had set up who was going to be on the show, and Kenny Greenberg. It was Wally Wilson is the producer of the show. He was a songwriter and producer, music producer guy, Nashville dude. He and Kenny Greenberg would kind of put the bands together and the artists. I guess Chad Cromwell had been doing the initial bunch of those shows, and he couldn't make a few of them because he was out touring with Neil Young or something. And so Kenny called me to come and do it, and I got to be on some of the really cool ones. It was like, I did the Billy Gibbons ones. It was Dr. John one.
Oh, man.
And Jerry Lee Lewis. That was incredible.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
That's crazy. How was that? Did he hang with him at all?
Only for a second. We said, you know, got to say hello to him and stuff. Yep. And got to play with him. I mean, we did a whole lot of shaking going on with him. It was unreal. I was like,
that's bananas.
It was totally insane. Totally insane. The musicians and the bands on that thing and the artists they had on that, those were pretty special. And also there was another, Don Was puts together some really cool things for this company called Blackbird Productions out of New York. And I got to play on a couple of those. One at Bridgestone they did was a tribute to Chris Christopherson.
Okay.
And that was a whole bunch of different insanely.
Is that a situation where you're in a house band with Don playing bass?
House band, yeah. Like, you know, playing with like Willie Nelson and Chris Christopherson at the same time. You know, these kinds of things where you're like, what is happening right now? I can't believe I'm doing this. Like, so incredible. And then we did an Emmylou Harris one as well.
Amazing.
Yeah. A bunch of different great artists on that. It's a lot of work and it's a lot of pressure. You gotta be great, but you know, it's so fun. It's really thrilling.
I won't take up more of your time. I really appreciate you.
Oh, thanks for having me. Yeah, this is really cool. I love doing this kind of stuff. So.
Are you in town now for a while, or are you guys like actively touring all the time right now, or what's
No, like we end up doing like two or three gigs a month usually.
Okay. Yeah.
During the school year, and then
that's
summertime.
Kind of a nice amount of.
It's great.
Hey, yeah.
I know. Yeah, it's a really, it's a perfect schedule for me and my family, and
yeah,
just for work in Nashville. And
so, are you able to like? You don't get into that situation then when people are like, "Oh, well, he's with Sheryl Crow. He's gone all the time," and so you miss out on stuff. Like people know that you're around. Is that ever a problem for you?
That hasn't been too much of a problem, just because the people. There's only a handful of producers that I'll kind of work with at one time during, you know, like for a number of years or whatever it is. So they'll always ask, you know, they'll still, you know, their production coordinators or whoever will always check in and say, hey, we have the session come up, be around. And so, yeah, so it hasn't been, and all the guys I work with pretty much know that I'm around more than
you would think.
Yeah. More than you would. Yeah.
All right, buddy. Well, I'll talk to you in a little bit. Thanks, Steve.
Okay. Thanks, Fred.
Okay. All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that episode. It was great to talk to Fred. And I'll be back in a couple weeks for another groovy episode of Music Makers and Soul Shakers. We'll see you then. Over and out. Music Makers and Soul Shakers is produced at the Hen House Studio in Nashville, Tennessee by Steve Dawson. Please remember to subscribe to the show and follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. You can find more info on this episode, including show notes and an audio playlist at makersandshakerspodcast.com. Thanks again to our amazing sponsors this season, Ear Trumpet Labs, Union Tube and Transistor, Black Mountain Picks, Isotope, and Spectra 1964. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.